Patty Shepherd is the mother of 11 children. She is a strong but damaged woman who's at the center of the new novel, The 12 Tribes of Hattie, a novel that has everyone talking. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. The 12 Tribes of Hattie is the debut novel of Ayanna Mathis. She sold the book right after graduating from the Iowa Writers' Workshop, and with that success, she was already living a dream come true. Then she got a phone call that would change everything.
And I answer the phone, and I say, hello, and then this voice says, this is Oprah Winfrey. And I said, no, it isn't, because I just didn't, I mean, it was just completely...
Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. When Ayanna Mathis got a publishing contract for her first novel, buzz started to build. Then the novel got noticed by one of the most powerful women in America, and the buzz exploded. The novel is The 12 Tribes of Hattie, and that powerful woman is, of course, Oprah Winfrey. When she picked the book for her book club, the publisher Alfred A. Knopf changed the first printing run from 50,000 books to 125,000 books, and Ayanna Mathis's life got a whole lot busier. She's taken some time to be with us this morning. Ayanna, thank you so much for being
here
today.
Thank you. It's a pleasure, Charity.
Let's start with focusing on the novel, and we'll get to talking about all of the many things that have happened in your life in the last few months a little later on this hour. But the novel focuses on one woman and her many offspring, and even one of her grandchildren. Tell us a little bit about who Hattie Shepherd is.
Well, in sort of practical, I guess, kind of biographical terms, she's a woman who leaves at a very young age, leaves Georgia, where she's born. Her father is murdered, basically, and she leaves in 1923. She leaves Georgia and she comes to Philadelphia. And when she gets there, she meets a man named August, who is her husband, who becomes her husband, and they have 11 children together. And she is a woman who endures a kind of pretty serious trauma very early on in her life when she's quite young. She has her first children. She gets married very young, and she has her first children when she's 17, and then they're twins. And they meet a very difficult and harrowing end. And that experience shapes Hattie in very particular ways sort of throughout the rest of her life. She's, I suppose she's a slightly unusual character in that I've been told I love her, but I've been told that she's difficult. You know, she's very difficult. She's a woman who is very angry. She is in many ways incapable of certain kinds of affection, though she is greatly capable of love. But she's also, I think, a woman who, sort of still waters run deep. I think, it's kind of beyond or inside this stoic, somewhat icy exterior, I think, is also a very whimsical woman, a woman who is prone to sort of a kind of almost sort of philosophical thoughts about, what she's doing here and what's happened to her life and et cetera, et cetera. I think she's a really interesting woman, if not immediately a completely likable woman in the conventional sense.
Would you read a little bit from the beginning of the book? And you mentioned that Hattie and her mother and sisters come north in the 1920s to Philadelphia. And this is a scene in the book that really gives us an idea of what that meant to her.
Mm. 32 hours after Hattie and her mother and sisters crept through the Georgia woods to the train station, 32 hours on hard seats in the commotion of the Negro car, Hattie was startled from a light sleep by the train conductor's bellow, "Broad Street Station, Philadelphia." Hattie clambered from the train, her skirt still hemmed with Georgia mud, the dream of Philadelphia round as a marble in her mouth, and the fear of it a needle in her chest. Hattie and Mama, Pearl and Marion, climbed the steps from the train platform up into the main hall of the station. It was dim, despite the midday sun. The domed roof arched. Pigeons cooed in the rafters. Hattie was only 15 then, slim as a finger. She stood with her mother and sisters at the crowd's edge, the four of them waiting for a break in the flow of people so that they, too, might move toward the double doors at the far end of the station. Hattie stepped into the multitude. Mama called, "Come back! You'll be lost in all those people. You'll be lost." Hattie looked back in panic. She thought her mother was right behind her. The crowd was too thick for her to turn back, and she was borne along on the current of people. She gained the double doors and was pushed out onto a long sidewalk that ran the length of the station. The main thoroughfare was congested with more people than Hattie had ever seen in one place. The sun was high. Automobile exhaust hung in the air alongside the tar smell of freshly laid asphalt and the sickening odor of garbage rotting. Wheels rumbled on the paving stones, engines revved, paper boys called the headlines. Across the street, a man in dirty clothes stood on the corner, wailing a song, his hands at his sides, palms upturned. Hattie resisted the urge to cover her ears to block the rushing city sounds. She smelled the absence of trees before she saw it. Things were bigger in Philadelphia, that was true, and there was more of everything, too much of everything. But Hattie did not see a promised land in this tumult. It was, she thought, only Atlanta on a larger scale. She could manage it. But even as she declared herself adequate to the city, her knees knocked under her skirt and sweat rolled down her back. 100 people had passed her in the few moments she'd been standing outside, but none of them were her mother or sisters. Hattie's eyes hurt with the effort of scanning the faces of the passers-by. A cart at the end of the sidewalk caught her eye. Hattie had never seen a flower vendor's cart. A white man sat on a stool with his shirt sleeves rolled and his hat tipped forward against the sun. Hattie set her hat satchel on the sidewalk and wiped her sweaty palms on her skirt. A Negro woman approached the cart. She indicated a bunch of flowers. The white man stood. He did not hesitate. His body didn't contort into a posture of menace, and took the flowers from a bucket. Before wrapping them in paper, he shook the water gently from the stems. The Negro woman handed him the money. Had their hands brushed? As the woman took her change and moved to put it in her purse, she upset 3 of the flower arrangements. Vases and blooms tumbled from the cart and crashed on the pavement. Hattie stiffened, waiting for the inevitable explosion. She waited for the other Negroes to step back and away from the object of the violence that was surely coming. She waited for the moment in which she would have to shield her eyes from the woman and whatever horror would ensue. The vendor stooped to pick up the mess. The Negro woman gestured apologetically and reached into her purse again, presumably to pay for what she'd damaged. In a couple of minutes, it was all settled, and the woman walked on down the street with her nose in the paper cone of flowers as if nothing had happened. Hattie looked more closely at the crowd on the sidewalk. The Negroes did not step into the gutters to let the whites pass, and they did not stare doggedly at their own feet. 4 Negro girls walked by, teenagers like Hattie, chatting to one another. Just girls in conversation, giggling and easy, the way white girls walked and talked in the city streets of Georgia. Hattie leaned forward to watch their progress down the block. At last, her mother and sisters exited the station and came to stand next to her. "Mama," Hattie said, "I'll never go back. Never."
Ayanna Mathis reading from her book, The 12 Tribes of Hattie. And that moment when Hattie and her sisters and her mother arrive in Philadelphia is a moment filled with so much hope. Mm-hmm. They've come from such a difficult circumstance with her father being murdered by white people in their community. Mm-hmm. They fled, really, for their lives. And things look so good at that point. But throughout the book, we do really understand that in spite of the fact that this is not the Jim Crow South, in spite of the fact that the Ku Klux Klan is not waiting around the corner, life is extremely hard at this time for African Americans in Philadelphia. How did you research what that time was like so that you could really create an authentic neighborhood and an authentic working environment?
I grew up, I should start by saying that my own grandparents migrated from the South, not from Georgia. They came from Virginia in the very early part of the 20th century. And my family is sort of, for lack of a more elegant term, just sort of old. My grandmother died in 2007 at 97 years old. And my grandfather died 2-3 years before that at 95. So my own mother is almost 80. So I grew up not so much directly with stories about the kind of period of Philadelphia in the 20s and 30s and 40s and 50s. It wasn't a thing that was talked about, but it's odd how people sort of somehow communicate the spirit of their time. You know, I couldn't tell you very many stories, particularly in which anyone said in 1925 things were like this. But it seemed to have been communicated to me, I don't know, by some sort of strange osmosis, by, I think, growing up with people who were so much of that generation. The sensibility somehow seemed to be present in me in ways that I didn't know were there until I started writing this book. So mostly what I would do is not so much front-end research, except in very, very specific circumstances. Like I had to make sure that there were no bathrooms in Jim Crow cars, for example, you know. But that kind of stuff, I think, was more fact-checking. Generally speaking, what I would do was just write it out according to my own sort of sensibility or sense of things, and also a lot of information gleaned by just all my own reading through the years, etc. Just write it out and then go back and check things that seemed like they could have been questionable.
Hattie, once she arrives in Philadelphia, swears she'll never go back and does not give in to nostalgia much about the South. But many of the other characters in the book really do, in spite of the fact that conditions in the South are so difficult in so many ways. There is quite a lot of nostalgia about the South. Was that something that you grew up with?
No, not at all. By the time I came, so my mother and all of her brothers and sisters were born in Philadelphia. So they have very little, and our family seemed to be very little interested in the South. So from my mother's generation, nothing. And from my own grandparents, they never talked about the South at all, whatsoever. I mean, it just wasn't a topic of discussion. And it didn't even seem like it was so much that it was a taboo, just that it was, I think by the time I sort of came on the scene and have memories of them, my grandparents were already in their 70s. And it was so sort of gone from them and so far from them that they just kind of didn't talk about it anymore. And it's interesting, though, because there is certainly in the book, you know, August has an enormous amount of August. That's Hattie's husband, right. Has an enormous amount of nostalgia for the South, and Hattie has absolutely none. I mean, she just sort of detests it. But somebody asked me once if I thought that August would want to go back to the South, if given the chance, would he? I don't think so. I think that he has a sort of immigrant's memory of it, you know, but that he would not actually want to return there. And it's interesting, too, you know, I think the experience of immigration is one that is so mingled for so many people and can be kind of paralleled, even though we don't think about it. And I think that's one of the things that's interesting about the Great Migration. We don't think so much. We don't parallel that movement to the great migratory movements that brought people to this country. You know, the Irish, the Italians, you know, the Germans, all these incredible movements that kind of made the United States what it is, really. But it is, of course, a movement that is along that scale, if not greater, in terms surely of numbers. I think we don't think about it because it's a migratory movement within the boundaries of the United States. But certainly in that sense, it is absolutely a migratory movement, and people had the same kinds of mingled relationships with the places they'd come from as they would in any other kind of migratory situation, I think.
I'm talking with Ayanna Mathis. We're talking about her debut novel, The 12 Tribes of Hattie. We'll continue our conversation in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. With me today is Ayanna Mathis. She is the author of the new novel, The 12 Tribes of Hattie, a new novel that you may have heard something about because it has been selected by Oprah Winfrey for her book club 2.0 and has been getting a lot of attention outside even of the normal circles where a very exciting debut novel gets a lot of attention. We've heard a lot about this book all over the place. And Ayanna Mathis has been dealing with all of that attention. And she's here with us today to talk about the book. And Ayanna, just before the break, we were talking about the Great Migration, African Americans moving north for the hopes of a better life, the opportunity to make a living and to not live in the Jim Crow South, to not face violence, to not face institutional discrimination, at least. This is also a period in time, though, when women, whether they are African American or Caucasian or whatever, this is a time when women don't have a lot of power. And that the role of women really plays a very strong role in your book. And could you read us a little bit from one of the chapters? This is when Hattie, as you mentioned, she has 11 children during the course of this book. And we just get glimpses into her life and the lives of those children at different times. It's not a straightforward narrative that tells the story of all these many pregnancies. But I think that there's a moment when she reflects on discovering that she's having a child late in life that really gives us an idea of a woman's place, a woman's struggle at that time. Mm.
It had been 5 years since Hattie last held a baby in her arms. She was 46 years old and thought she was finished having children. When she missed her period, she'd hoped her change of life had come. She'd had enough of blood and milk and birthing. But then came the swollen breasts and the craving for shaved ice and cucumber slices and the familiar pulsing in her belly. She had never gotten over that pulsing, two hearts beating in her body. When she felt that, she knew, no need to go to the doctor. She told August while they were lying in bed one evening. "You'll have to get the Moses basket out of the attic," she said. He bolted upright. Hattie could feel him smiling, and she wanted to turn over and slap him. All of the years of their unhappiness hadn't diminished their physical need for one another. Days passed in which she hardly said a word to her husband, but their nights were another thing, their bodies were another thing entirely. Hattie said and did things with August she was ashamed of. In the middle of the night, when they were lying in bed panting and sweaty, they would stare at each other, stunned. She didn't know what to make of this sporadic urgency with him. It had confounded and humiliated her for the 30 years of their marriage, these endless pregnancies, and worse, her body's insistence on a man who was the greatest mistake of her life. She was only 15 when they met, too young to understand that getting her alone at his brother's house was all August had wanted from their courtship. After, when he tired of her and stopped coming around, Hattie never let on that she was heartbroken, sick to her stomach, couldn't sleep at night, heartbroken. Mama was right to call him my ruin, Hattie thought. If I had known things would turn out this way, I would have thrown myself in the river after I buried my twins. Maybe you can see about picking up again at the Navy Yard, Hattie said. Mrs. Mark might not need me anymore. She's moving down to Florida to be with her grandchildren. You worrying already. We gonna work it out, August answered. It won't be no harder than with the rest. Ain't none of them gone hungry yet. Haven't they? Hattie thought. Down the hall, the children slept three to a bedroom. Hattie could almost hear them growing, their wrists lengthening and poking out beyond the cuffs of their sleeves, their feet outgrowing their shoes, their shoulders widening and pulling the fabric of their coats taut. For the last 2 weeks, she had fed them with navy beans with ham bones for dinner and powdered milk and oats for breakfast. They were lean. They had that hard look that was disturbing in a child's face.
Ayanna Mathis reading from the 12 Tribes of Hattie. And as is alluded to in that passage, Hattie and her husband August marry young. They start having children right away. And she, after she loses her twins, which happens very early in the book, is so sad and in some ways broken mm-hmm. by that experience, which affects her and her children and her husband forever. Mm-hmm. August deals with this by getting out of the house.
Yeah.
By spending a lot of time with other women, a lot of money on other women, yeah. on alcohol, and never had a regular steady job or mm-hmm. did from time to time. And at one point in the book, he even reflects on that and thinks, if Hattie's mother hadn't died before the twins were born, he thinks she would have left him. Mm. And that puts, for me, in such stark relief, the very few options that mm-hmm. she had as a woman, because she could have gone back to live with her mother. Mm-hmm. But what else could she have done?
Not much. You know, not much at all. And this is, you know, I mean, I think class comes into this enormously as well. You know, She, you know, Hattie's as a woman who was, you know, had been kind of middle class in Georgia where they were, but Georgia middle class with obviously severe limits because of the racial situation. And then she sort of, they come north and they become very much working class. So this isn't, you know, Philadelphia was a really interesting place. There were obviously sort of freed black slaves that had lived there, or people who had never been slaves. And then there was, you know, it was a huge center of migration. So there was a strange kind of class strata that grew up. throughout the years that black people have been living in Philadelphia. So there was a very kind of like sort of poor class. And then there was Hattie's class, Hattie and August's class, which was an aspirant middle class, but working class. Like nobody had any money, but they all had these kind of, you know, middle class aspirations, you know, but they were very poor, obviously. And a woman in that sort of strata really had no option. She didn't really have an education, you know. Presumably, perhaps if they had stayed in Georgia, maybe the family would have been able to send her to Spelman or something like that. And then she could have become a teacher or perhaps a nurse, maybe something like that, you know. But given what happened, you know, and the fact that she and her mother and sister had to flee, that is no longer a possibility. So she now is a woman with no education, really, except for, you know, I mean, obviously she's literate, but she's no advanced education whatsoever. And so her options are, she doesn't have any options. She can, you know, the sort of kind of horrible nexus of class and race and gender at that time, her options would have been to, even for work, which she does do, she could have cleaned houses, maybe. She could do some sort of cooking kind of thing, you know, she could sort of cater. But had she left her husband, especially after her mother's death, there would have been no place for her to go, especially as a woman who had children already.
Right. No child care.
Exactly.
Is possible.
None.
No birth control.
No. I mean, I think that she could have. Certainly Hattie has a very strange relationship with kind of having these children. She and I think that she's less a victim in that regard than she would be, or than she might be perceived to be, except of her own kind of hard-headedness. You know, there's a woman who kind of comes in and out of the novel named Willie, who everyone sort of refers to as a juju woman. Now, obviously, at this point in time, there was no legal birth control. And obviously, there was no abortion, you know, clearly. So I'm stating the obvious, but, you know, forgive me. But there were sort of kinds of herbal remedies, aside from the kinds of, you know, medical procedures that women of more means might have had access to, which were still horrible and would have, you know, killed them half the time. But Hattie wouldn't even have had access to those because of her financial situation. What she would have had access to would be kind of neighborhood juju women, which would be kind of a person who works with herbs and things like that. In the book, this woman's name is Willie, who would have kind of given her something to get rid of the pregnancy, you know, which would have been some kind of, you know, concoction of herbs that would have been effective. So she kind of may have had that option. It's not really a good one, though, you know.
Well,
and she also
really,
is proud. She wouldn't have, you know.
You, throughout the book, with different women characters, you recognize the fact that they have sexual needs, mm-hmm. which is at a time, in this time, something that was not recognized mm-hmm. socially.
Right.
Something Hattie struggles with herself, but clearly an important part of life. Whenever mm-hmm. anything takes place. But as I mentioned during the book, you give us windows mm-hmm. into the lives of these different characters, and you travel through time from the 1920s to 1980. Mm. And many of her children, there's a moment where there's a whole chapter devoted to one of these children as mm-hmm. they're growing, either most of them as adults mm-hmm. or near adults. And as a reader, I found myself working very hard to pick up on the clues that you left for me about time and about who this was, because you never give us a list of all these kids. You never tell us who's, you know, we know who's the oldest, we know who's the youngest, but in between, right. it gets a little bit muddled for the reader. Although when I got done reading the book, I thought, 11 kids, and I counted them up on my fingers and I knew them all. So I did get to know the family. But how did you keep track of it? Did you create a family tree and a timeline so that you knew where everyone was?
Yeah, that was a really kind of difficult piece of the book, I think. In some ways, as I wrote them out, I would have a sense of what their story was going to be, and not necessarily in all its specifics, but some sense. And as the book moves forward in time, their problems and their issues become in some ways sort of more modern in a certain kind of way. So, for example, with the chapter called Belle, which happens later in the book, it's set in 1975, and Belle's problem, you know, Belle has tuberculosis, and she's got this lover that she's left, and I won't give away sort of the really stunning thing that she does, but at any rate, her problems are very much have to do with her own kind of ennui and her own strangeness and her own kind of orneriness, and she's kind of a pain in the butt as a person. But they have very little to do, I think, with the sort of legacy of the South. And so it became very obvious to me when dealing with a character who feels very modern like that, that she couldn't possibly have been, you know, somebody whose story took place in 1942, let's say. So many of the characters, there was that kind of thing, like whatever the sensibility was or their particular set of problems or their circumstance kind of dictated when I knew that the story would have to be set. But then certainly, you know, the chapters were not written in the order that they appear in the book. And so after, when they were all kind of said and done, there was a great deal of what a dear friend of mine has called novel math, where I had to kind of go back and be like, all right, well, if Hattie was born in this year, then this person is this old when we meet them in this year, in this chapter, there was, you know, so there was kind of a chart that had to exist and get kind of rejiggered several times because things weren't working. It was a little bit of a kind of like a, you know, pulling out my hair moment. I remember the day that I did the chart and I was like, oh, this will be fine. It'll take me like 2 hours maybe. And it took something like 10 hours. And I was like really, really just upset afterwards and frustrated. It was really much more difficult than I thought it was going to be.
Did you have in your mind a lot more backstory than for these characters than made it into the book? Because as a reader, I trust you that you know everything about this family. Do you know everything about this family? Did you have ideas of the kids' relationships with each other and all of the stuff that happened when we aren't seeing it?
I think to some extent, certainly, yes. But I don't think in terms of sort of knowing what happens to them after we meet them. No, not really. I think certainly more about them that makes it onto the page, which I think is necessary to write any kind of character convincingly. You know, I mean, you have to know more about them than what actually sort of appears in print. Otherwise, you will create a kind of a very superficial and false portrait of them. But most of what I think I know about them tended not to be so much their circumstance as much as their sort of psychology and the kind of workings of their hearts or their minds or kind of how who I think they are as opposed to what happens to them. There are a couple, you know, like my assumption is that a character like Floyd, he's a jazz musician. We meet him very early in the book and then just sort of don't see him again. It gets referred to a little bit later on. But a character like Floyd, and he's gay, I imagine that at some point he kind of found a lover and was somebody, but probably much later in his life, who he kind of settled down with, although still kind of in secret because it wouldn't have been, you know, it would still, even when Floyd is around 50, we would only have been in the, you know, late 60s or something like that. And that he would have continued to be a musician and been a good one. But that's kind of like surmising about him in the way one might surmise about somebody that they knew in grade school. You know, it's not very real to me and it's not fleshed out. It's just sort of a vague idea of what could have happened to him. And about the others, I don't even have that so much.
A lot of very difficult, tragic things happen to the characters in this book. And you have managed to write it in such a way that even though it is bleak, and it is depressing. I won't lie about that. But you wrote it in such, I don't know, a big-hearted way that it didn't crush me. How did you walk that line between telling these stories that really were so difficult and bleak, but not having it be so bleak that it was difficult to read?
I really believe that it is possible to write about people who are in very, very difficult circumstances without writing a book that is despairing. One of the great lessons, I think, is to be found to that end is in The Sound and the Fury, in Faulkner's Sound and the Fury, which, I mean, a more sort of bleak and you know, despairing set of characters you could not come across. Nothing good happens to anybody at any moment ever, and it's not going to. But, you know, you walk away, at least I do, you walk away from The Sound and the Fury and you feel that you have had an experience with the sort of consciousness of other human beings. And you feel, I do at any rate, that a real communion has occurred. And that is done through his, I think, great compassion for his characters. And I think also, you know, the notion of leaving one's own consciousness and sort of and having an experience of community with another kind of consciousness, even though they are fictional characters, that seems to me to be a kind of anti-despair. You know, it's very affirming of what it means to be a human being. It creates empathy. It creates all kinds of some of the sort of most beautiful things that we kind of can do and experience with this human consciousness that we have. And I think in some ways, not necessarily consciously or sort of on purpose, I think that is some of what I was trying to do with this novel, that I was trying to tunnel deeply enough into these people's psyche and into their lives that a reader would have a sense of having communed with another human being. Whether I've done that or not, I don't know, but I think that was my attempt. And that, I think, is what saves it in some ways from despair.
Did you ever feel cruel, like you
sure.
you weren't being kind to these people?
Sure, sure. I mean, certainly the first chapter in which Hattie loses her children, that was a very difficult chapter to write. But the rest of the time, not so much. I think in one chapter, which is called Alice and Billups, again, sort of later in the book, it's about a brother and sister, and the sister, you sort of classes out of the family. She sort of marries up, if you will. And I had to rewrite that chapter a lot for various reasons. But one of them is because I think I didn't like Alice very much and I wasn't dealing with her compassionately. And so there was a great deal of rewriting that had to be done until I got to a place where I could be sort of honest about her, but wasn't. I had sort of gotten rid of some of my biases because she wasn't being treated fairly. But in other circumstances, I don't think so. Certainly hard things happen. But I think that the characters are also given or allowed to have, in much the way that people do, these kinds of moments of beauty, you know. And I think that is also sort of saves them from a kind of utter bleakness and utter despair, and saves me from feeling that I have treated them horribly.
I'm talking with Ayanna Mathis. Her first novel, The 12 Tribes of Hattie, has just been released. And we'll continue our conversation in a moment. We'll talk about her time at the Iowa Writers' Workshop, and she's here now teaching at the University of Iowa. That's coming up in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. My guest today is Ayanna Mathis. Her first novel has just been released. It's called The 12 Tribes of Hattie. You may have heard a little bit about it because Oprah Winfrey chose it as part of her book club 2.0. It's been getting a lot of attention because of that, although it's also been getting great reviews and a lot of attention just because it's a truly outstanding debut novel. And I think about, in the novel, most of it takes place in Philadelphia, and I've mentioned it spans the time from 1920-something to 1980. I have a hard time imagining you in Iowa City, because you wrote most of this novel in Iowa City when you were here for the Writer's Workshop, right?
Yeah.
How did you transport yourself there?
That's funny. I suppose, you know, the imagination is such a strange and quirky and miraculous beast, you know, with which we are all so wonderfully and miraculously endowed. I think while I was here in Iowa, what I was given was an incredible gift of time. You know, I kind of left a career in New York, and New York is just a very busy place anyway. And I left a full-time job and all that kind of stuff. And so I was sort of given this gift of time. I mean, my job here was to write. That was what I was supposed to be doing, 24/7. And I think in that space and in that time, everything that was probably kind of forming and what things my imagination was working on, things that I thought were important to me or things that mattered to me kind of above all else, were given this odd space to sort of cohere, you know, and come out onto the page in many ways. And I think also Iowa, because it is so, and Iowa City in particular, because it is such a literary kind of town, you kind of feel like you're in this sort of odd cocoon, you know what I mean? And if you're working on a project really intensely, you can kind of create this almost sensory deprivation thing where it's just sort of you and the kind of workings of your mind, which is very strange and a little dangerous probably in some ways, but was very productive for me.
You grew up in Philadelphia.
I did.
And you went to New York to go to college?
I did, yeah.
you pretty much stay in New York after
I
that?
I did. I moved a little bit. You know, I lived abroad for a few years and that kind of thing. But pretty much New York has been my home since I left Philadelphia when I was 18.
And you built a career, a successful career, in magazines.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I did. Magazine journalism. I did fact-checking for many, many years, lots of that.
What made you want to, at this point in your life, chuck it all and go to the Iowa Writers' Workshop? What planted that seed?
I've been writing since I was a kid, so writing isn't new, but I think I had I wrote poetry also for a very long time, and then I stopped writing poetry at a certain point, not against my will, kind of. It went away, which was sort of traumatizing. Then I stopped writing altogether for about 5 years. But I'd been writing, you know, all of my adult life and had a mingled relationship with, I think I was afraid of it, really. So I would kind of start and stop, and I would write really seriously for a year, and then I wouldn't write at all for a year, and that kind of thing. And I'm not sure exactly what happened. You know, I had been living abroad. I lived in Italy for 5 years, during which I didn't write at all. I came back, and I sort of prose occurred to me. Who knows why? And I sort of started taking some writing classes, which I had always done kind of periodically. And I took one class that an incredible guy named Jackson Taylor taught, and he just was an incredibly motivating and encouraging teacher. And I suppose I met him at a time, I think I was maybe 34 when I started taking that class, something like that. I met him at a time when writing oddly began to be a bit more urgent to me. And as I sort of was in that class and was so incredibly encouraged by him, I also met a very dear friend who also went to the Iowa Writers' Workshop named Justin Torres, who wrote a book called We the Animals. He was in that class. That's where we met. And then he came to Iowa the next year. And an MFA had never occurred to me. I didn't have kind of careerist impulses or notions of writing. I just thought, oh, this is something I will always do, and I will always make my bread and butter in some other way. And after Justin left, I came to visit him, and it just is a sort of perfect storm of occurrences. You know, a building urge to write. The fact that my best friend came here and I saw that it was like what it was like and realized it was an environment that I would like. This class I was taking, very, you know, it's a little bit mysterious, I suppose.
Well, when you say that the idea of writing as a career didn't occur to you, a lot of people think that they're going to be novelists. Mm-hmm. A lot of people. But in practical terms, it is not a practical career choice. So was that what was going through your head? That, well, I love to write. I have stories to tell. But becoming a novelist is mm-hmm. is pretty out there.
I think so. I think surely there was that. There's sort of it seems kind of a ridiculous idea, you know. I think surely there was some of that. And I think also it just was outside of the realm that I thought of being possible for myself. You know, it was sort of something that other people did, you know. And I didn't know people who, even in my 30s, I certainly knew a lot of writers, I knew poets, but I didn't know people who kind of made their living as writers, really. So that also, it seemed like a thing that other people did or would do. It didn't seem any kind of personal goal at all.
So you come to the Iowa Writers' Workshop, you take that leap of faith, really take time out of your career, of your life, and you write this book. And then how long did it take you to find a publisher?
It happened very, very quickly. The whole thing is kind of a strange miracle. I finished right around when I graduated, which was May of 2011. I already had an agent that I had sort of met while I was here at Iowa. I finished in May 2011, and I sent it to her, and she said, "We're ready. Clean up your typos." And so I sent it back, and she sent it back to me, cleaned up my typos, and it sold. I think I gave it to her sort of in its finished form the end of May 2011, and it sold on July 1st, 2011.
Wow.
So it was very, very quick.
I can only imagine your elation when that happened.
Also because I was leaving Iowa and going back to New York, and I was like, well, I could go back to magazines, but I didn't really want to. Something sort of strange had happened while I was here, which is I was like, I think I'm a writer. But I didn't know. I moved back to New York. I didn't know. It's like, what am I going to live on or do? This is very helpful that the book sold that quickly.
Absolutely. Absolutely. When you got the book contract, how did you imagine the audience that this book would connect with? Who did you think was going to read it?
I didn't. I have a strange way of dissociating from the events that are happening in my life. I don't think I imagined so much right then who would read it. I as time went on, I think I thought, well, you know, it'll. I hoped that it would be well received, sort of critically. I thought that New York readers would read it. Maybe people in Chicago will read it. That's a big, great migration city. You know, I had this very vague notion of kind of who my readers would be, which sounds kind of silly, but I really didn't have a fully formed idea of who they might be.
Did you imagine that it would have more appeal to African-American readers?
I thought so. I thought that it would. I thought it really would depend on how it was presented, because I think it resonates. Lots of African-American readers kind of will see their grandmothers and mothers, and obviously it's about the Great Migration, so surely. But what my fear was, I think, was that it would be kind of, you know, we have this terrible habit of kind of segregating our cultural products in this country. And I had a fear that it would be kind of marketed, which is an ugly word to use about a book, but is also the reality of publishing in some ways, that it would be marketed as only an African-American book and that it wouldn't reach other kinds of readers. And that was disturbing to me, because I think that there is much in this book that goes. And in fact, the people that I've met since it's been out, you know, people of all races, I met this like Navy captain guy who was like in his late 70s, who was talking about how he Hattie reminded him of his sister. I mean, I think there is much in the book that crosses racial lines and that is accessible, I think, to everyone. And the sort of misfortune of the way we sometimes market things is that we're told that things are not accessible to other people. Oh, this only Black people will understand this book, which I don't think is true, and I think is untrue of many, many, many cultural products. So I was scared of that, but fortunately it didn't happen.
You were already living a first novelist kind of fairy tale.
Yeah.
Anyway, and then the woman in the United States that has more power to make people pick up a book than any other person in the United States, perhaps in the world, picks your book for her book club, Oprah Winfrey. How did you find out that she had done that?
I was on vacation, actually. We hadn't been on vacation for a while. I was on vacation with my partner. We were in Paris, and there was this whole kind of, it's a big secret when the Oprah thing happens, and nobody knows. So nobody, you know, my publicist didn't know, my editor, nobody knew. What we did know, what we were told, was that O Magazine had decided to review the book, and that instead of just doing a very brief review, they were going to do something that was more like a paragraph long, and they wanted a little quote. And so we're all like over the moon, because
sure.
It's great if you get a review
That's
in Oprah
huge.
Magazine.
You know,
it's enormous. And so they said, well, you know, we're going to press. And so I know she's on vacation, but we need just a quote, just a sentence. We just talk to her 10 minutes. That's it. And I was out sightseeing. I remember this. The call was set up for 2 p.m. and I was expecting the book's editor of O Magazine to call me. So I come rushing back. And I, you know, we get into the apartment that we were renting, and I'm sitting there, and some time passes, and at like 2:11, the phone still hadn't rung, and I'm thinking, oh, well, maybe the phone's not working. I don't know what's going on. Maybe I should call them. And the phone rings. It's 2:12, and I answer the phone, and I say, you know, hello. And then this voice says, this is Oprah Winfrey. And I said, no, it isn't, because I just didn't. I mean, it was completely unbelievable. I mean, what, you know, it was really. Really very unbelievable.
Is it still a little unbelievable?
Of course. You know, it's odd the way one processes things, which is, I think I kind of process them by not processing them. You know, it go into sort of duties mode. You know, I need to go and do this. I have to be on the radio. I have to do, you know, an interview. But I don't really kind of process the event that I think that it spawned all of this. You know, I think I still probably don't know what to make of it, really.
I can't imagine what that felt like. But all of a sudden, your book is not being marketed to African Americans. Your book is being marketed to every person mm-hmm. everywhere. Mm-hmm. And the audience is limitless in some ways.
Yeah, it's really something. And I should say also, you know, sort of in defense of Knopf, my publisher, I think that they were going to do a very broad marketing scale too. But what I was more afraid of is that the trend would kind of overwhelm their marketing scheme, and what would happen would happen. But certainly this way, you know, any danger of that has been avoided. And it's really something, because I do think it's reaching readers that it wouldn't have reached. And not only is it reaching readers across racial lines, but it's reaching readers across that kind of false literary fiction line, you know, where people are kind of told that they can kind of only understand books that are more commercial fiction.
Right.
And so that people who read mostly commercial fiction or people who aren't quote unquote literary people are kind of encouraged to feel that certain books are over their head or out of their league or and are not of interest to them. And one of the incredible things that happens with the Oprah Book Club, because she is, you know, if I can sort of use the word, kind of a populist, the books that she chooses, which are, you know, I mean, they're Faulkner, they're beloved, the books that are really complicated but that have so much to offer any reader, are that sort of false barrier and that I think somewhat elitist barrier gets broken down.
Right. She
and
can
so
knock
all
that
kinds
wall
of
down.
Exactly. She knocks it down. And so all kinds of readers approach all kinds of books, which is amazing.
So you're at this point where you're trying to figure out if you're a professional novelist or what it is that you're gonna do to keep yourself alive and even having a good debut novel that is well received does not guarantee monetary success.
Oh, no.
for most people. and suddenly you have this, in some ways, rocketing to superstardom in the literary world. How does that change how you think about who you are and what you do?
I think sort of fundamentally it doesn't. I mean, I'm very fortunate. I'm 39 years old, and I'm very, 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 very glad. I'll say very one more time, very glad that this didn't happen to me when I was 25 or 26, because I think that it would have sort of thrown me off in incredible ways. But at this point, as much as sometimes it's overwhelming and sometimes confusing and on all of these kinds of things, I think that I have a fairly clear idea. You know, like when I left Iowa, I thought this is my life's work. And this was even before the book sold. But I thought this is my life's work. I hope that this book will sell to a good publisher so that I can do my work. And I am fortunate to be the age I am and to have had that realization before any of this started, before it even sold. And that, I think, has stayed the same. So even though I am kind of I am absolutely in the midst of an incredible whirlwind, my sense of myself as a novelist, I think, hasn't changed. The challenge will be obviously to find a place of quiet so that I can write again. I'm not writing at all now, which is fine. My job right now is to sort of be Hattie's ambassador in the world. And so that's fine, you know, and it takes up a lot of time and that's absolutely fine. I have no complaints. But at a certain point, this part of my job will end and my job will then be to go and have my tea and sit in my sweatpants and write again. And the challenge, I think, will be to find the sort of mental and emotional quiet that's required for that. But I do feel very fortunate. I feel somewhat grounded in at least kind of knowing what I think my path is, if not the particulars of it.
As Hattie and her children go out into the world and you know that they will be read, they will, thousands and thousands of readers will get to know them. Mm. Maybe many, many more than that will get to know Hattie and her children and this place and these times. What do you want people to get out of reading your book?
Well, I certainly hope that people will come away with some understanding. There's so many answers to that question. I think one of the things is that people will come away with some understanding of the ways in which, to sort of return to a question you asked me earlier, of the ways in which it is possible to sort of understand that a character or set of characters are different than you are, but at the same time to find something that is resonant in their experience and that relates to you. And so that certainly at the same time that those differences are true and are there, they are not barriers. And I hope very much that will be the case with Hattie. I also hope certainly that Isabel Wilkerson wrote an incredible book called The Warmth of Other Suns, which brought an enormous amount of attention to the Great Migration. But I hope that this book will help people to think about it. I don't think that this is a book about the Great Migration, but certainly it's an important part of it. And I hope that people will kind of come to just to sort of recognize, you know, this enormous thing that happened in this country that changed the country. I mean, we wouldn't have jazz if there were no Great Migration. You know, I mean, it just changed everything enormously. So I hope that people will think about it in that sense. And I also hope the last thing is that, as you said, you know, these people don't have quote unquote happy lives, but they certainly do have moments of selfhood and of beauty that are important and that are sustaining. And I think that that is also very much the case with people's lives in general. Certainly, we hope that most people's lives are not as traumatizing in certain ways as the characters in this book, you know, as the lives of the characters in this book. But certainly that people kind of exist on a, or are told that they ought to be existing in some kind of continuum of happiness that makes them feel inadequate. I think that's not true. And I think that people are often, you know, we go through difficulties and we go through hard times and we go through all of these things, and life is often not what we necessarily want it to be or what we expect it to be. But we are saved by moments of grace and of beauty and of communion. And I hope that the book in some ways will sort of emphasize that, you know.
Ayanna Mathis, thank you so much.
Thank you very much for being here. It was such a pleasure.
Ayanna Mathis is the author of The 12 Tribes of Hattie. This semester, she's teaching at the University of Iowa. I'm Charity Nebbe. This is Talk of Iowa.